Please.
One of the main problems with Australia is the close relationship with the United States. As an outsider, what would you say to peace activists in Australia? How could we put any pressure to break down that relationship?
Great, great question. Another one. Yeah, please.
The summary at the end was really helpful. I suppose some of the analysis that I have been reading and listening to talks about the Western Empire being in decline, and it being in decline economically, clearly from the 2008 financial crisis. And you know, part of the reason that it is so invested on continuing the genocide is that the Axis truly does pose an actual threat to Western hegemony. If they back down, then that's going to embolden the Axis, and that's going to embolden the other countries around the world to actually stand up to the West. But that ultimately the West is, Western hegemony and empire is in decline, and I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Sure. Another one. Yes, please.
I just wondered, you never mentioned the non-aligned movement, which started in the 60s, didn't it?
Okay, take these three and then three more and so on. I actually think that the decline question, West is in decline. By the way, the best speech at Davos this year at the World Economic Forum was given by the insane president of Argentina, Javier Milei, where he gave a speech about the West in decay, as if we have to defend the West against the barbarians and so on. There's a lot of this talk that's been going around, defend the West. You know, Trump is, of course, famous for, U.S. President Trump is famous for this kind of language of decline that needs to be reversed. You know, the decay and decline that needs to be reversed. But in fact, one has to be a little more careful about that assessment. So again, in the work of our institute, we operate with the sense that there are five controls that an imperialist power requires. Three of those controls, the West is finding are being contested, but not two of them. And this will be familiar from what I presented. The first control is control over raw materials. The West no longer has command over raw materials, I mean, despite the fact that Rio Tinto and so on have such great offices. I mean, the Niger government has said, we want to control our uranium. Countries around the world are saying, we would like to have a better share of royalty of our various reserves. Congo is putting its foot down on some agreements and so on. It's contested. It's not that it is lost. Second, control over finance is contested. 70% of developing countries are under US sanctions. They have been trying to do runarounds the dollar. China and Russia themselves largely trade outside the dollar. Again, it's contested. There is going to be no de-dollarization likely in my lifetime, because no other country is going to open its assets for free buying and selling. You can't become the reserve currency if you have capital controls. And the Chinese are never going to give up capital controls on their currency. Very unlikely the yuan will be the reserve currency. I don't see any other currency coming in. There's some talk of a BRICS currency, maybe the SDRs in the IMF and so on, but these don't feel to me legitimate at this time. So it's not that the whole financial system is going to change overnight, so you can rest easy about your pensions, but on the other hand, it's contested. People are contesting it. The third area of contestation is science and technology. I mean, until 10 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that many of us would carry telephones from non-Euro-American countries. You know, used to be Nokia, then the Apples came in, and blah, 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 right? Now, I mean, I don't know about you, but like in places like India, Southeast Asia, on the African continent, almost everywhere except South Africa, most people have Korean and Chinese phones. Most people. It's either Huawei, Honor, something like that. If they have a phone, it's a Korean and Chinese phone, or a flip phone that's made in some smaller manufacturing company, knockoffs and so on. People can't afford to buy the American commodities. You know, the Apple phone is super expensive. So you buy an Honor phone or something like that. So science and technology is contested. There are two areas, no contest. Number one is the military, what I mentioned earlier. Nobody can actually take on the United States. Now, people have argued and said, well, you know, the US lost in Afghanistan. Okay, yes, the military had to withdraw, but they destroyed Afghanistan. I mean, the US can flatten a city. It can't necessarily govern places, but they can just bomb the place, you know. The Iranians are not worried that the US will come in and occupy Iran. They'll be fought every step of the way. It's usually a patriotic country. But they can flatten Tehran. They can flatten Qom. They can flatten Mashhad. They can flatten the major cities. Iranians just don't want that, you know. I mean, the US is never going to invade China. It's crazy. It's unthinkable. Even in, there's been no movie that I know of made of a US invasion of China. Even filmmakers can't imagine it. But US missiles could flatten Shanghai. It could they could flatten Beijing very fast. Dangerous. No military contest. The fifth area of control where there's no contest is information. None at all. How quickly and easily it was for the United States, their media, and one guy living outside Washington, D.C., a German right-wing conservative, so easy to convince the whole world about a genocide in Xinjiang. And yet till today, 11, 12 months after, 13, 14 months after the genocide in Palestine, people hesitate to use the word. Well, it's not really a genocide, you know. Well, Hamas did this, and their control over the information system is complete. You know, if they say you're a genocide denier, you're a genocide denier. That's on your, it's on your gravestone. I mean, I was surprised before I arrived in New Zealand that there was this text circulating about me saying he denies all these genocides. And I was thinking, you know, you'll get academics from the United States funded by Open Society, Rockefellers, you know, Oppenheimer Foundation, Ford Foundation. I've never heard anybody being criticized in a letter, being said, you know, you've received funding from the Fulbright Foundation, which has helped in the coup d'etat. I've never seen that in my life. You know, I looked around on the internet for people coming from the US to Australia. Nothing. From England, coming with money from the Rhodes Foundation. That's Cecil Rhodes, okay? He's the guy who seized, you know, large parts of Africa, killed millions of people. People coming with Belgian foundation money, money that was stolen by King Leopold from Belgium. I don't see anybody being condemned. But when I was coming here, you deny the Uyghur genocide, you deny the Tamil genocide. I thought, really? How did you get that? You know, from one article which I wrote about the JVP as part of the NPP alliance winning an election in Sri Lanka, and one tweet I sent when I was in Sri Lanka saying, this beach is beautiful. Somebody said, how can he say the beach is beautiful? There's a genocide down the road. It's the complete enveloping of the human brain by the Western information system. Complete enveloping of the human brain by the Western. There's no contestation. The Russians, Chinese, they are accused of disinformation. They don't know how to do it. Who watches Chinese news? One or two people, that's it. RT is banned in so many countries. The information system is total. People's brains are taken over. You watch this stuff, you absorb information. I mean, if the Russians were bombing the Ukrainians like the Israelis are bombing the Palestinians, you would get 24/7 footage of neighborhoods wiped out. But they are not bombing the Ukrainians like the Israelis are bombing the Palestinians. And yet, there are probably people in Australia who think that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is worse than the Israelis bombing the Palestinians because of Hamas. And that's the information control, which is almost total. And there may be some people in this room who believe that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is worse than the Israeli bombing of the Palestinians. That's the stunning part of it. I mean, what does one say about the NAM? It's been there, but it's been dormant for decades, and it has been unable to move an agenda. I wrote a book called The Poorer Nations, which makes the argument that in fact the BRICS has surmounted the NAM. The BRICS is basically creating a new NAM, you know, by expanding. So the NAM exists, but it's largely an irrelevant body. I'm really interested in the things people could do in a country like this. You know, for instance, after the horrendous NATO destruction of Libya and the racist sidelining of the African Union delegation, which was sitting on an airfield in Addis Ababa, ready to go to both Benghazi, a second visit actually, to Benghazi and to Tripoli to meet with the two sides in the conflict. That was a plane filled with heads of government and others, including Jacob Zuma of South Africa, who was then the president. They were told by NATO, do not take off, we are bombing. Just when they were ready to go on a peace mission, NATO told them, you can't fly, we're bombing, sorry, you are canceled. This is on the African continent, where the African Union should have had some sovereignty over NATO bombers. And they were told to sit down and shut up while NATO conducted its bombing raid. In the aftermath of that, the African Union had a multiple year discussion. And eventually in 2016, its Peace and Security Council passed a resolution against foreign military bases on African soil. Our institute wrote a dossier on it. Basically, this resolution has been ignored by the world press. There's no real press that covers the African Union proceedings. It's treated as a complete sideshow. I think that's super racist. I mean, I bet that the Australian media, or what is it, the Murdoch media, doesn't bother to cover what these, you know, what the deliberations are in the African Union. They think it's all useless, they are irrelevant. What's really important is the African subcommittee of the US State Department. Cover that to learn about Africa. Don't bother about what Africans think. But why can't there be a movement for no foreign military bases on the Australian soil? I mean, if the African Union can do it, why can't there be a move from legislator to legislator, starting with the most favorable province, where there's some place to start a discussion? What's the point of having green representatives in the West Australian parliament if they are not going to table at least a discussion about foreign military presence on your soil? What's the point? I mean, then they should just resign, you know? I mean, I don't see the point of being in a parliament if you're not going to put your agenda forward, however fruitless that possibility of it passing. You keep hammering on, and that's important. And the second thing is, it's pretty ridiculous that the Australian federal government and provincial governments are using your funds to build military facilities for the Americans. I mean, you are paying for the expansion of Tyndall to place B-1 and B-52 bombers there with nuclear weapons in violation of a treaty your government signed, Treaty of Rarotonga, nuclear-free South Pacific. Your government is a signatory, and yet you're going to allow US nuclear bombers to come and station in Darwin within flight distance of China. Instead, why not spend that money to build one train that links Sydney to Canberra? The major city, biggest city, and the capital. There's no train. It's ridiculous. I mean, what is this? You know, there should be a train that runs from Canberra to Melbourne.
There is one.
Really?
Yes.
It carries passengers?
Yes. Yes.
Is it a high-speed rail?
No.
You see, I understand that Australia has a lot of coal. You're going to keep digging coal and so on. I get it. It takes time to transition. You know, being an Indian, it's hard for me to criticize that. We are also in a long transition. But why allow people to fly when they can use the train? Why have domestic flights, at least in that part of the country? I don't know this. This is my second day in Western Australia. First time here, second day. I don't know exactly what cities you could build a train to. Okay, but I'm sure there are places. I mean, this province is the size bigger than Europe. There must be other places than Perth. I don't know if there are trains going there. Yeah, I mean, these bread and butter choices, you know, guns and butter choices, sorry, guns and butter choices. Do you want to spend your precious social wealth on a base for the Americans? Or do you want to build public utilities for yourselves? It's a basic constitutional discussion. Is this a country for Australians or for the United States? I mean, I know this used to be a country for Great Britain without a treaty and so on. I know it used to be basically a British country, still have a king and so on. But it seems that you're basically a country for the United States. And that's something that if you have self-respect, my dear Australians, you would fix. That's not enough. That's not enough. Okay, let's get three more. Yes, please.
There is a, like, I feel like the left is very afraid of talking about the axis of resistance, the resistance groups as they are. I would like to know what your thoughts about that.
Okay, yeah.
So, first of all, thank you for the insightful, amazing speech. I read your report on hyper-imperialism earlier today. I just have to ask, like, for the diverse global south countries, the ones which are maybe not the leading part of the global south and also not the global north either, how do we get out of enmeshment within like Western finance capital, especially for the smaller countries who may not have their own financial basis?
Great. Yeah.
My question is about the seemingly vassal states in the Middle East, UAE and Jordan, and to a lesser extent maybe Egypt and Saudi. And what are the means of control that the Western Empire has over these states, and where do you see them landing in a potential big regional war? Sorry, good question.
From here I'm going to Sharjah, and Ruben is taping this. But I just no, no. I mean, look, let's be quite frank. That what's called the axis of resistance has been made illegal in most of these countries. If I walk down the street with a Hezbollah flag, I probably would be arrested. So there's a problem with even talking. You know, I mean, like all these groups, Ansar Allah in Yemen, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, right, all of them are basically, I think, proscribed organizations, yeah, in Australia, as they are in many countries. That proscription helps silence a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm from Brazil.
Yeah.
There is a fear of talking about these organizations as resistance groups, and there's always this "do you condemn Hamas" thing, and I think it's within the left it's a bit problematic because these people are resisting occupation and colonization. So,
yeah, I mean, on that basis, here's what I would say: in 1967, Israel occupied Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. These are official occupied territories. The UN calls them occupied Palestinian territory, in not plural, singular. It's one occupied Palestinian territory. After the United Nations designated these three parts of that region as the OPT, anybody living in that territory is by international law given the right to resist their occupation. And they are allowed to resist their occupation by all means. That is established international law. So there is nothing illegal by international law about what any of the groups have done since 1967. Because it was not always Hamas, Islamic Jihad. The early groups that took up arms were in fact Fatah, leading member then of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, led by George Habash, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and many other factions, small factions, you know, some based in, whose headquarters were in Damascus, but they had militants in the West Bank. They had the right to resist. Israel and the United States, again, one country, very cleverly used the language of terrorism against them. But let's also not forget that until 1994, in fact, right till 94, the United States considered the African National Congress to be a terrorist organization, and it was proscribed. The Southwest African Liberation Organization, Southwest African People's Organization, SWAPO, which now is in government in Namibia, whose prime minister, she is a member of SWAPO, that was a proscribed organization. These were all proscribed organizations, all terrorist organizations. Nelson Mandela himself was considered a terrorist. So now the question is, why can't we defend somebody who is fighting for the end to their occupation and international law provides them the ability to fight? I personally think it's cowardice not to defend the right of an occupied people to defend themselves, precisely because that's international law. And I would be very happy to challenge that in a court, because that's international law. Now, with the case of Hezbollah, for instance, Hezbollah is a political organization now within Lebanon, has members of parliament, but also has a paramilitary organization that was born during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon. And while Israel occupied Lebanon till the year 2000, Hezbollah had a legitimate right to defend itself. Since 2000, Hezbollah operates in Lebanon. I used to live in Beirut, so I know a little bit about their operations. They operated south of the Litani River, in the basically the UN zone. Now, this is highly contested, because UN resolutions have said that they cannot be armed, that that's a UN peacekeeper zone. But Hezbollah is still in that territory and considers itself the first line of defense against Israeli aggression. Now, they were also born under an occupation. Ansar Allah was not born under an occupation. They were born in the middle of a civil war against the government of Mr. Saleh, who was the president of Yemen at the time. Yeah, Mr. Saleh was basically doing the bidding of the United States government. WikiLeaks cable shows him talking to US generals, where Ali Abdullah Saleh tells them, you bomb the Al-Qaeda camps in the Hamdurat of the west, the eastern part of Yemen, and we'll take responsibility. Even though Yemen's government had no missiles. So the US was firing cruise missiles, and the Yemeni government of Ali Abdullah Saleh was taking responsibility. That's when Ansar Allah was born in the north as a political movement, initially among the Houthi religious community. But they are not born under an occupation. They have a different locus standi. They are now the government of Yemen. So when they fire missiles to defend the Palestinians, they are doing it as Yemen at war with the Israelis. There's no declaration of war, they just do it. So these are different kinds of organizations that have been participating in trying to defend the Palestinians. But many of them have a legal right to do so. So the fact that a government has proscribed them is in fact interesting, because it suggests that that government is violating international law. But what can I say more about that? Because I get into trouble. I have to leave tomorrow, they might say. I don't mind getting into trouble. I really don't mind it on this, but this is unnecessary, you know. These people have no imagination. Well, you know, small countries, in a way, are always in a tough position. You know, there is the prejudice of the big. I mean, in the 1980s, when Julius Nyerere, president of Tanzania, was asked to impanel the South Commission on behalf of several of the countries in the non-aligned movement, and he created this commission which wrote a report published, unfortunately, on August 2nd, 1990. It's the worst date, worst publication date in history, because that's the day Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Nobody was interested in this book. It's the worst publication date. In that report by the South Commission, a very important report, they basically argue that in the world, the big countries of the South need to become the locomotives. They basically say the NAM is not effective. We need to allow the big countries of the South to grow and become the locomotives of the South. And that really, in a way, is the theoretical origin of the BRICS, in many ways, yeah? Small countries always face a certain prejudice, you know, but small countries also have an advantage. It's an advantage and a disadvantage. Depends where you are in the world. If you are in proximity to a large country, it is an enormous disadvantage, regardless of the politics of the large country. You know, China is a very large country. You're at a huge disadvantage if you are in proximity to China. So you're at a disadvantage because it's hard for you to drive an agenda. On the other hand, enormous advantage. Laos, for instance. Laos has one of the best train systems in Southeast Asia. The Chinese have run a train right down through the middle of Laos to Vientiane. So the people of Laos have great train transportation, but it might not exactly be the axis they wanted the train to run on. They may have wanted it 10 kilometers to the west or east, right? So there are advantages and disadvantages. It's hard to set the agenda when you're a small country. This is just a problem all around the world. It's not about politics. It's about scale of country. Now we need to have a debate and discussion where the scale of country should not, it should not define the kind of input a country can make into international affairs. I mean, look at the climate change debate. The small island states have no say in the discussion. None. They've been trying to argue for a concept, climate refugees. Nobody cares. So scale is important, but we can't underplay the fact that it's a problem, yeah? I don't know what the answer to you is, except that if you're closer to a big country, it's more likely that you throw in your lot with a big state, like Belarus and Russia. You either throw in your lot, or Lithuania and Germany, or NATO. You seek protection. I mean, one of the problems with our world today is that we really don't have good mechanism for states to have security. Arms control agreements have collapsed globally. Border issues are completely unresolved. You know, we have border disputes all over the place. Like, the climate is collapsing, but we are fighting about where the border is. There's so many compelling issues where small states are prejudiced, and we haven't found a solution to that. I'm not answering your question, am I? You wanted me to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify what exactly I was trying to ask there was how these diverse, like, global South countries get out from, is there a path out from this, like, IMF, World Bank, international financial system dominated by the US game, if you don't have your own industrial base, if you don't have your own control of industrial base, all resources?
I mean, it again depends what we're talking about. So, I've been following carefully the China-Africa, what's it called, the China-Africa dialogue. China-Africa something. I think it's called a dialogue, but it may be called something else. I'm not sure. Forgotten. It's an annual meeting. been following that. In the initial period, there were all kinds of things on the table which seemed sort of leftover IMF-type discussions. Corruption, this, that. Last couple of years, the issue on the table has been industrialization, where the Chinese government has said, look, we want to help you industrialize. Now, there are many reasons why this is good for the Chinese. It's not like they're doing some sort of charity work. They are trying to upskill their economy. It's the old Japanese flying swan thing. The lead swan goes here and you pass on the next stage of development. Could be very well that. But small countries could have easily taken advantage of this. In fact, if Zambia had a different government, it could have become the centerpiece of the industrialized Africa strategy. Because Zambia and the DRC signed an agreement during this period to build an electric car, or at least good quality electric batteries. And the United States then came in the middle of that, brought Angola along. Angola left the group of friends in defense of the UN Charter, abandoned that. And the United States called the heads of government of Zambia and the DRC. They made a three-way agreement to build a battery and a car. And then they built the Lopito Corridor project, or at least in paper, that would go from the DRC to Angola to a port. And so then the batteries could go to Europe and elsewhere. So, I mean, it's interesting how the US came in the middle there when they were not needed. Because the Zambians and DRC said, we'll build a battery and then a car. The US didn't provide anything more than that. But they did provide the Lopito Corridor to take the batteries out of Africa towards Europe. And also, most likely, they won't allow the Zambians and DRC to build a car which doesn't have US components. So there was no need for them there. Zambia could have been a shining star of the breakaway, but they came in very quickly. It was interesting. Let's take the case of Egypt. Safe case. You know, if you go back in history to the 1940s, Egypt had bought for very large sums of money the top equipment, military equipment, after World War II. You know, King Farouk had just sent the wealth of Egypt to arm itself. Why? I don't know. 1948, the Nakba happens. The Egyptian army is sitting at its bases. They barely move. The Air Force doesn't really fly. There's some movement, but they don't do much. When the Nakba comes to a slow close, the United Nations comes into Gaza. Actually, it's an Indian battalion that provides peacekeepers in Gaza. It's a fantastic story about Jawaharlal Nehru visiting Gaza in the 50s. The Egyptian army internally starts to have a discussion about the uselessness of King Farouk. In 1952, the free officers that had this debate overthrew King Farouk, put him on a boat, sent him off, and that was Gamal Abdel Nasser coming to power. So I have often thought that in Garden City, in Zamalek, in Cairo, all these colonels and captains are watching Al Jazeera and watching what is happening in Gaza. And they are driving from their bloody Air Force bases where they have new F-16s and F-35s parked there, which they know how to fly. And they are not being permitted to take off, forget Zamalek and Garden City, but the pilots who have to sit in the Sinai, in the bases in the Sinai. 20-minute flight to Gaza. Can you imagine, why aren't they getting into the damn F-35 and flying it over Gaza to establish a no-fly zone? Why isn't one air commander not mutinying and taking his battalion, you know, not battalion, his air corps over Gaza just for a fly around, just to tell the Israelis, we're here. Come back, get court-martialed, but your dignity is intact. I don't know the answer to that. But I'm hoping. Nakba was 1948. The coup was 1952. That's 4 years. The war started in 2023 against the Palestinians. We are in 2024. Sisi better watch out. Take a couple more.
How do you talk to normal people about...
Normies,
like people who don't really, about the axis of resistance and their less developed progressive social issues? I try to make the point that we didn't get gay marriage till 2017 or something, and that they should really just come around on their own time. And then, second question, do you think India will move further away from the West? I heard that they just took back a bunch of gold from London to store in their own place, so maybe they're preparing for something? No?
That's two questions, don't forget. Yes.
What's your...
You already had a question.
What's your prediction of Israel's future?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question about talking about class distinctions within countries that are not in the US bloc, because it's something that I read your hyper-imperialism and obviously listened to you speak now. I think it's something that you don't talk about that much at all, and I think especially if we're talking about countries like Iran, like China, like South Africa, like there's enormously significant class distinctions. There's been working class rebellions that have been suppressed, strikes that are suppressed. So. You know, I think, you know, this, we want to defend them against, well, you know, especially with Iran at the moment in the Middle East, like, it's not an aggressive, you know, it's under attack from Israel, and it's abhorrent, but I think there is still importance to talk about class distinctions, especially as a Marxist, so I wanted you to comment on that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's deal with the India one first. By the way, that gold that India has started to take back was gold India sent in 1991, July, to get a loan from the Bank of London. You know, when the West wanted a loan to save the Western financial system, India, Indonesia, China didn't ask for France to send gold. They were idiots, they should have. Because India in July 1991 was forced to ship 148 tons of gold to London, and they're slowly getting it back. So that's not, that's something else. But the question about India, I'm going to talk about tonight. I can't help it. Can't give you the lecture now. Fair, right? I mean,
it'll be recorded, right?
Human being. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. Recorded? Maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know.
It's in the hands of Murdoch.
Murdoch. Not named after that Murdoch. Another Murdoch. They're all Murdochs.
But it's
same family. Different Murdoch. Okay. Your question is really interesting. About the, you know, let's take Hezbollah as an example, yeah? So when I lived in Beirut, I was very interested in a story that was coming out of Saida, the southern city, south of Beirut. And so I decided to just go and poke about a bit because the news was not very well told, I didn't think. What was happening was somebody had gone and bombed a couple of breweries and a pub where alcohol was served. Somebody had gone and actually destroyed these places. So I was interested in that and went down to Saida and met the people who owned at least one of them. Another one that I met didn't want to go on the record. And the third one I couldn't find. He claimed the money and left. So the one who talked to me and said he would go on the record told me that after the bombing, political leaders from Hezbollah came to see him. And they first apologized for the bombing and said it's not Hezbollah who did it. But they said they brought a message from Syed Hassan Nasrallah. And the message was that here's a pledge that we will rebuild your brewery. We are against alcohol and drinking, but we think you should have the right to have alcohol and drink. Hezbollah is the most misunderstood organization, in fact. They have never tried to impose a social ideology outside those who belong to their ranks. They don't do it. I mean, I lived there for 2 years, traveled around southern Beirut, in towns where Hezbollah has a majority control. They control all of the government. They don't ban alcohol. They are a unique and interesting group. Why? Because they reflect the culture of Lebanon. Lebanon is a very peculiar place. It is a sectarian paradise of all these different sects and groupings and so on. So in Lebanon, Hezbollah is not trying to impose anything on anybody, interestingly. In fact, in the case of the old synagogue in downtown Beirut, the old synagogue which had been built by one branch of the Sassoon family, you know, these are the Iraqi Jews from Baghdad. One branch went to Calcutta, where I was born. One branch went to Paris. The Paris one created Vidal Sassoon, and the Calcutta one financed the synagogue in Beirut. It had been destroyed during the civil war. Hezbollah paid part of the money to rebuild the synagogue. Partly this is that idea of confessional faith, that, you know, they like other people who believe in God. They are less clear about atheists. So they funded the building of the synagogue. For those, you know, who say it's anti-Semitic organizations, why would they rebuild a synagogue? They are a very unique and interesting group. I mean, human history doesn't come to us in a straight line. It comes in all kinds of manifestations. Iran is a very complicated country. You know, it's not, those who have traveled, I've traveled in Iran, it's not that everything that meets the eye. I mean, one of the first experiences I had in Iran, driving in from the Tehran airport years ago, was seeing a couple of kids, a boy and a girl. The girl, full hijab, was there on skates with a bungee cord being dragged by a car. That was my first experience of Iran. You know, it's a country. There are people there. They're not cliches. There is a big division and fight inside the leading groups in Iran. There are people who are having disputes of all kinds of political kinds inside the Iranian parliament. You know, there are lots of women in the parliament. They are debating and discussing all kinds of issues. The question isn't, what does one condemn? You know, it's easy to have a position of, well, there's, you know, we should have a class against class position on international relations. It's easy to do those things. But these are complicated countries with complicated histories. And one has to really understand what kind of workers' movement is able to develop, how one supports the workers' movement. If you think the best way to support the workers' movement in Iran is by writing things in Australia, you're going to hurt them. That's the worst way to support. Hey, can I, can, could I finish what I'm saying?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Like the
right. Yes. I'm actually answering your question. Yeah. So if you think the best way to support these movements is by taking them up in the West and writing about them in places like Australia, you have completely missed the point. Because you will just get people in trouble. The best way to work with those organizations is try to find the way they would like to be supported. So for instance, in Iran, and without saying too much, there are all kinds of groups that want to have discussions, private discussions on Telegram channels, that when they want publicity, they will ask for it. But mostly they don't need it. And I think there's a lot of carelessness in the way solidarity is offered to groups around the world. If you just support a group, that can be a death sentence for somebody. You have to support them patiently, carefully, understanding what is possible, and not without a sense of the realities in that country. I've traveled there. I've met with a lot of union organizers in Iran. They have their own understanding of how they need solidarity, how they want their struggles to proceed. There are times when they may want help. For instance, a leading Palestinian Marxist was arrested in Damascus in the 1990s. I led the international campaign for his freedom from prison. But that's because his family was very concerned that if there was no international campaign, he would not be freed. And Khalifa was eventually freed from prison. But that's because they made an assessment saying they needed an international campaign, particularly one that included significant figures, cultural figures from the Arab world. So I remember getting Mahmoud Darwish, Marcel Khalife and others to sign a letter, because they are people with cultural resonance in the Arab world. So my answer is, by all means, support anything one wants. But in our work, we tend to think that one has to be careful in how we write about parts of the world. Now, of course, there's class struggles in different parts of the world, and of course, that is written about where appropriate. But in that text, we were much more interested in trying to understand what are the national divisions in the world. It's not a complete text. It's not a complete history of all relations in the world. It has a limited scope, and that's what the scope is, to understand what is the category global north, what is the category global south. It's a provisional text. We welcome people to write critiques of it and so on. You're welcome to write a critique of it, but it has a very specific objective. It's not a total history of the world. There are other places where one can sit and understand, well, what are the class realities in South Africa? For instance, we work very closely with the National Union of Metal Workers and write a lot about them, produced a lot about them. But we produce it from their perspective. We let them guide how we should write about them. We are not going to, you know, write about them because that's not how we operate. You know, so even when there's class struggles within a nation, it's always best to allow the people in that nation to set the tempo. Yeah? Now, in terms of Israel's future, who knows? Certainly, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. In the middle of this election, Netanyahu fires Gallant, who himself is a genocidaire, as I said. But he also leads the less right-wing faction of Israeli politics. They have been calling for Netanyahu's removal. I mean, I don't see what the future lies for that country as it's constituted now. If the United States wasn't a part of Israel, Israel would not have survived this. If they were not getting resupplied constantly, if the US didn't build that shipping wall around the Eastern Mediterranean and the Gulf, Israel would not have survived. It would have been finished. But they would not have survived if they were not part of the United States. So given that they are a part of the United States, which is how I see it, they will come out of this okay. There will be political disaster. Netanyahu might get thrown out, but likelihood he will not. Trump is most likely one. He's going to allow Netanyahu to do something terrible, even more terrible. They might launch a strike on Iran tomorrow. Not tomorrow, January tomorrow. Because from now till January, Biden will still be there. But from January tomorrow, they might launch a strike on Iran. The Iranians are probably getting ready for it. So then I don't know what happens. You know, I was talking to Barry earlier that if the United States places intermediate range nuclear missiles in Taiwan, and if they strike Beijing, North Korea is going to flatten Tokyo. It's like a nightmare. It's a nightmare. We don't want to go there. Nobody wants that. And this is what these provocations, you know, you would think that analysts in the United States, having seen how it played out in Russia, would not want to follow the same script with China. You know, the Chinese have openly said, we do not want a confrontation. I was at a presentation in Beijing, listened to top think tank officials talk about the situation. They don't want a conflict. They say it openly. But they also say, and this is very important, we will not return to 1840. There will not be a third opium war. We will not be humiliated again. We don't want a conflict, but we will not be humiliated again. And that is something for us to think about seriously. Because that's what a lot of this pressure campaign seems to be leading toward. Take one more from Barry, since he's been standing this whole time.
Okay, I've got another question, I've got an announcement. Okay, folks, what you've been hearing here is anti-imperialist Marxism if you like what you're hearing and you want to get involved with Red Ant, hey, there's a contact list right here on the table. And also, right next to the door is that blue placard with a QR code on it. Zap that and join Red Ant. We need good people. Please, join us. That's all I want to say.
Okay, I thought you were going to ask me a question. All right. Itching along, 247 to Trump, 23 to go, almost done. What? Almost done. Well, friends, it's really nice to be here. Thanks a lot. I think we won't take another question. You want to wrap it up? Or are we okay? Or do you want to take one more question?
You guys have one more question.
One last question. Going, yes. One, two, quickly. Because I have to go buy a suitcase. Yeah. The things one has to do when you're on the road for a month. Yeah.
I just want to come back to you said we don't have a security system anymore. And the nation states are problematic. There is quite a lot of debate now about the reviving the sort of idea of Westphalian system. What do you think about that?
Okay.
Escalationist, the thought of Western hegemony being maintained continually from here is too much for me to bear. So I'm wondering if maybe you tempered your responses because you're on camera, but I feel like I've been given a bleak outcome.
Yes. No, it's actually not a bleak outcome. But I wanted to also speak a little bit against the triumphalism that exists among a lot of people who believe that somehow the West is done and that multipolarity is here and they celebrate the BRICS summit in Kazan and so on. This is a very long road and there's going to be a lot of dangerous things ahead. There will be a lot of ugly conflicts. The very fact that this even neo-Westphalian idea has not been able to stop this genocidal bombing in Gaza is actually a sign of our deep weakness. It's a sign of our weakness. And what I'm suggesting to you is that our principal weakness lies in the enduring hegemony of the United States and its bloc over weapons and information. That is where the enduring hegemony lies. And it's not going to be undone by more weapons. The Chinese and others getting bigger weapons, and that's not the way forward. The way forward is to fight for disarmament. The way forward is to rebuild the peace movement. You know, I was in New Zealand, as I said. New Zealand had an incredible campaign for nuclear disarmament. New Zealand's people fought to create a treaty against nuclear weapons. But it's dead. I met one of the daughter of the founder of the CND. It's dead. Australia, I mean, IPAN exists. But for God's sake, it's not a vibrant, lively thing. Lots of young people, you know, maybe young people for a while were motivated by climate change. But that has also demoralized people. You know, they are not out on the streets. And look at the information order. When Greta Thunberg was standing there and talking about climate, they kind of lifted her up in the international media as this, you know, young child who's incredible and so on. The moment she naturally radicalized and started talking about Palestine, closed. That's the evidence of how the information system works. If she's acceptable, it's on their terms. When she's not on their terms, unacceptable. We have to fight this. We have to fight against this kind of information hegemony. You know, we have to fight to build a more robust picture of the world. That means that all of us have a responsibility. You know, you can't expect to read a newspaper, change its position. It means we have to be out there talking to people, building movements. Movements are the best information system in a society as far as any kind of socialist or peace idea is concerned. No mainstream publication is really going to commit itself to peace. There's too much money in war. The only information system for peace is the movement. That's it.
Thank you.
That wasn't bleak. Thanks.
Thank you, folks, for joining us this afternoon. And a special thank you to Vijay Prashad for his speech. If I am to just say one last thing, listening here, coming down to these lectures, developing your political understanding, reading theory, reading Lenin, it's all well and good, but it means nothing if you aren't organizing. There was a Chinese man, he once said, in order to know the taste of a pear, you need to taste the pear. In order to understand politics and radical thinking, you need to engage in radical organizing. And if you're interested in that, and you're interested in more than just reading and watching and listening, head down to Barry in the back. Thank you for your time. Yeah.